Hillary.
Radio. Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth, bringing on four or five great guests every week, telling it like it is, way outside the mainstream box. And I'm always looking for perceptive analyses of aspects of reality that aren't being sufficiently attended to in the mainstream. And we found one today. You know, I think it's just blatantly obvious that Hillary Clinton is a very weak candidate and that Trump has all of the advantages if he goes head-to-head with her. But a lot of folks don't seem to get that, and the mainstream is still telling us that Bernie Sanders is this weird McGovern-ish, way out in left field kind of guy. He could never beat, you know, anybody, but least of all Trump. But Hillary, now there is the icon of an American dynasty, yada, yada, yada. I don't think the electorate sees it that way. I don't think that's how it's going to play out, and neither does my guest, Musa El-Gharbi. Musa El-Gharbi has a very, very interesting kind of situation. He's, let's see, I'll let him go ahead and explain it himself. You're moving to Columbia University now and working in sociology. Go ahead and tell us about your work first.
I do a lot of work on the sociology of knowledge and on social epistemology. So I was at University of Arizona. I have a master's in philosophy from the University of Arizona, and I'm teaching in the School of Government and Public Service there. But in the fall, I'll be starting at Columbia University in the Department of Sociology.
And you have a background also in Mideast Studies. You're the managing editor of Southwest Initiative for the Study of Middle East Conflicts.
Yep, SISMEC. Yep.
Okay. Very, very cool. Well, I thought this was a very interesting and perceptive article at Counterpunch on Trump versus Hillary. You know, I've seen a couple of other good analyses along these lines before, but surprisingly few. It's kind of amazing how few people see what looks obvious to me. Now, why do you think the political system is so out of whack in this election season, and why aren't they getting what you're saying about Trump versus Hillary?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of people are hesitant to accept the fact that so many Americans would resonate with the message of someone like Donald Trump because he's so xenophobic and nationalistic, and whereas the Washington sort of establishment has a very much more like internationally minded focus, and they try to, even though a lot of politicians on both sides, but particularly on the Republican side, do race baiting and, stoke various types of xenophobia or, you know, prejudice against different sectors of American society. We like to pretend as though this is not an integral part of, you know, American society. And Trump is sort of turning that rock over, and we can see all of the creepy insects crawling around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm in this alternative information community, you know, ever since I was driven out of the University of Wisconsin by some angry state legislators back in 2006 for questioning the official account of 9/11. So I've been running with the folks who don't buy official paradigms about a lot of things. And some of those folks, I mean, they're people, you know, in this alternative community from all sorts of different perspectives and walks of life. But some of them are sort of nationalistic peaceniks, people that within the mainstream paradigm would be associated with names like Pat Buchanan, Justin Raimondo of antiwar.com, people who are basically kind of conservative, who in some cases are very pro-American nationalistic, and who believe that wars are actually the product of the internationalists, And these people hark back to that tradition in American politics of people like Charles Lindbergh and others who resisted, and back to Bob La Follette, too, you know, people who resisted U.S. involvement in the world wars. And frankly, I think that they have some pretty good arguments. And some of these people think that Trump actually would end up being a very good pro-peace candidate for this reason. They see him, you know, as being in that line. You think that they are right or not?
Yeah, so in one sense, yes, right? So if you listen to his speech at APAC...
I'm afraid to.
Well, there was a lot of horrible, you know, boilerplate stuff about how, you know, Palestinians breed terrorism and all of this sort of stuff that all of the Republicans harped on. But at the same time, there is a very fascinating undertone underneath it. So he was very critical of the UN, but not, but, you know, for the sake of saying that the international community shouldn't be telling, you know, nations how to. So, yes, there's this very nationalistic vein to Trump in his foreign policy. And he has repeatedly said that he doesn't want to get dragged into, for instance, in Syria. He doesn't want to go to Syria. He wants to try to drive ISIS out, and he thinks it'll take, he said military advisors have told him it takes 20 to 30,000 troops on the ground to do that, but he said there's no way it's going to be American troops, so either the other people are going to pony up some ground forces, or, you know, they'll have to find some other way to do it. So he does have this very nationalistic foreign policy, and he's not for getting dragging the U.S. into conflicts. Even with regards to Russia, he's saying, you know, NATO has cost America far more than it's delivered for America. And it's an antiquated thing that was designed to contain Russia. And Trump wants to have better relations with Russia anyway, and he doesn't see a lot of value in continuing with the NATO system. So even with regards to NATO, he caused a lot of stir yesterday by not suggesting that we abolish NATO, but suggesting that the U.S. reduce its role in NATO, and that other European powers should play a bigger role if they want to do, you know, the kinds of things that NATO has been doing.
Right. So given that, there seems to be kind of a disconnect between this sort of, you know, nationalistic xenophobia, which is associated usually with a bellicose, aggressive foreign policy. And for example, of course, the caricatural image of the Nazis, the ultimate evil satanic enemy, this, you know, image that's still brandished about to try to get the U.S. into these various kinds of wars by saying we'll be like Chamberlain the appeaser if we don't. We always imagine that the nationalist is the warmonger. And yet you could easily argue that it's these American exceptionalists who are in some ways, you know, have an even more ridiculously exaggerated notion of America than Trump does, who are the ones who are leading the U.S. into all of these wars that are bankrupting the U.S., that are ending civil liberties in the U.S. and globally, that are wasting resources that could be used for helping people live better, and certainly helping the poorer people do better. And so, you know, for all of these reasons, it seems to me that when people are afraid of the fascism, supposedly this extreme nationalism of someone like Trump, and you could make the same argument about people like Yvonne Le Pen in France and some, maybe not all, of the European sort of nationalist parties, that, you know, maybe that's actually wrong, you know, poorly founded. That in fact, especially in the case of the U.S., if the U.S. went back to minding its own business, and if we made America great again by fixing the U.S. within the U.S. and scaled back our foreign commitments and foreign adventures, which have killed over 50 million people since World War II, according to Chomsky and Volcek, that this would be a really good thing. And so, again, I have friends and people in this alternative community who like Trump. And I don't know. Do you think a President Trump is there, you know, what odds would you give for a President Trump being, you know, a total disaster or actually a major improvement?
Well, it's hard to predict. He's hard to predict as part of it. But I will say that one thing that you can do now, for instance, is is you can look at how Trump would approach a lot of issues versus how Hillary Clinton would address a lot of issues. And people, again, the narrative is that Trump would clearly be worse. And it's not, it doesn't strike me as being that straightforward. Again, I am not a fan of Trump, but I am also not a fan of Hillary Clinton. But so, for instance, if you look at surveillance, right, Trump was saying that the United States should place much more heavy surveillance on Muslims. And as a Muslim, obviously I'm not a fan of that idea. But then when you look at Hillary Clinton's alternative, it's, she's a big fan of the NSA wiretapping, of expanding sort of intelligence operations on U.S. soil. So her alternative is we should spy on everyone more. Is that better? I don't, and it's not discriminatory because it's not focused on Muslims in particular, but to say it's better to spy on everyone rather than a particular group, that doesn't strike me as being clearly better. What would be better would be to roll back these programs for everybody. But that's not what Hillary Clinton wants to do.
Right. And again, it does seem that Hillary Clinton is very much an imperial candidate committed to continuing with the imperial policies that have led to this surveillance state that we're in now. Trump, it's not so obvious. But here's my concern. You know, if we had a Trump presidency, I wonder whether the neocon, extreme wing of the imperialists wouldn't be so panicked. You know, they might be afraid they're going down. You know, some statements that Trump has made are probably rather alarming to them. For instance, when he said, "Elect me and you'll find out who really knocked down the Twin Towers." It's kind of an amazing statement for a Republican leading candidate to make. And it's probably quite alarming to the neoconservative wing, because if I don't know if you've looked into this, but I think if 9/11 ever really gets blown wide open, then that's the end of the empire, and it's certainly the end of the neoconservatives. And that's, they're also, even barring that, maybe they could stop that. There are a lot of other things about Trump that probably concern them. So I would worry that a Trump presidency could conceivably be accompanied by another big false flag like 9/11, which turned the Bush ticket. The Bush-Cheney ticket was supposed to be against nation building. It was very much like Trump in that respect, criticizing Clinton and Gore for being too internationalist, getting U.S. committed all over the world too deeply and so on. And then they essentially, by staging 9/11, they forced the Bush presidency into this eternal war on terror on behalf of Israel, the neocon program. And we could see something like that. Trump, who, if he comes into power bashing Muslims, yet he is kind of leaning towards maybe a more sort of nationalistic and anti-neocon policy, and he's unpredictable, they could try to steer him in the direction they want, and perhaps in a really extreme direction, by another big false flag. And then, Trump, the guy who wants to do terrible things to Muslims, would be put in a position of, either trying to expose it, which would lead to civil war. And I've been told by high-level intelligence people that, they knew what 9/11 was, but they weren't able to push back against it openly hard enough to do anything, because it would have meant civil war. Well, the same thing would happen in this scenario, and Trump would essentially be forced to go along with the program, which could mean, internment of Muslims and things like that. So that's my nightmare scenario. Do you think I'm just a paranoid conspiracy theorist?
Well, it is hard to predict what Trump would do in the event of a substantial attack on U.S. soil. I mean, that is one of those sort of variables that would be very worrying, because he's so unpredictable, because he's very concerned with, showing strength, and because there are these pre-existing narratives about Muslims and, surveying Muslims and having Muslims walk around with like special Muslim identification and stuff he suggested before. So, I mean, I think it could go down a pretty dark path in the event of an attack. But it's worth noting on the flip side that the neocons right now seem to be sort of hedging their bets on Hillary Clinton in the event of a Trump versus Clinton race. A lot of prominent neoconservatives like Kagan have explicitly said that they prefer Clinton to Trump and that they would endorse her or support her. I think that that kind of endorsement would do more harm than good to Clinton, especially with her base. But that's what they want to do.
Yeah, well, they might be able to bring in some money for her. Maybe they can get Sheldon Adelson to pony up.
There's a lot of money there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that maybe the neoconservatives are a little bit upset about, you know, being hoisted on their own petard in a way, because I think their game is to try to create public conditions where the, you know, it's a problem reaction solution kind of thing, where they create the perception of a huge problem, so the public is clamoring for a solution, and then they can sort of give half of the solution that the public is clamoring for and appear to be the moderate ones. You know, that's why you have people like even Netanyahu, you know, saying, oh, Trump doesn't want Muslims to immigrate to the U.S. He's gone too far. You know, wait a minute. Yeah. Netanyahu, the genocidal lunatic who's, you know, done so much so much for Muslims in occupied Palestine, saying something like that. Well, that's because these folks, people like Netanyahu and the neocons, I think, their way of governing, of course, was to, you know, they believe in the Straussian system, the system based on the politics of Carl Schmitt, that all politics is based on enmity. So the only way that you create political bonds between people is to create or find an enemy to rally against. And their system for doing that, I think, is not to do it in a sort of out-of-control way. I think they believe that the Nazis did it in an out-of-control way. And so, you know, Leo Strauss came to America. He had to flee Nazi Germany. You know, he carried the teachings of Schmitt to America. And he said, you know, the United States is sort of like the Weimar Republic. It's ready for somebody like Hitler. You know, we need to find a better way of managing it, and we need to do it through this rallying people against the enemy image. And, of course, that was what happened in the Cold War. These neocons were the Team B people who portrayed this grotesquely exaggerated Soviet threat and to rally the people and to get have big military budgets. And then that fell apart at the end of the Cold War. And so now they've been doing the same thing against Islam. But their technique is to create a huge public outcry. They didn't have enough of a public outcry against Islam prior to 9/11, even though they did false flags in the African embassies of USS Cole, the World Trade Center 93, which even the FBI informant has told us was that bomb was built by the FBI. He recorded himself talking to his FBI handler, confirming that that bomb was built by the FBI. So these were all false flags. Oklahoma City was originally supposed to be blamed on Muslims, but that went wrong. And even that, by the end of the 90s, they still couldn't get any kind of foreign policy consensus, as Brzezinski would put it. So they did 9/11, and that really got the American people riled up. They would have been ready to, you know, basically gas all the Muslims in concentration camps if they had their way. But the neocon leadership, of course, meets them halfway and, you know, does all of these measures, including the murder of a million Muslims worldwide that we've seen ever since. So I think that's the neocon program. And Trump is, like, basically going all the way with the riled up people who've been terrorized by these false flags to hate Muslims. Well, Trump's going to go you one better than the neocons and accept the paradigm that the neocons have created. And I think the neocons now are finding that problematic. You know, that's not their way of trying to manage the world, and especially it's at the service of essentially a so-called isolationist program. So that's kind of my analysis of why they don't like Trump. Why do you think they wouldn't like Trump? Here he is. He's you know, he's going and kowtowing to AIPAC. He's ranting against Muslims. I mean, why wouldn't they like him?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that he is harder to control, right? He's not as predictable. And this is part, for instance, the way he's funding his campaign. You know, it's not totally self-funded, but it's largely self-funded, and in part because he's very effective at, you know, manipulating the media outlets and stuff so that he doesn't have to do a lot of ads and things like this. So he's running a very cheap campaign, actually, but a very effective one. But so in a lot of ways, he's not as accountable and he's not as entrenched in the whole machine as a lot of other politicians are. And I think that's one of the issues with the neocons, is that they can't control him. And then another issue is that they do, as you said, the neocons and the neocon administration has been responsible for, you know, killing more than a million Muslims since 9/11, as well as, you know, interning Muslims without trial, surveilling mosques, all these, you know, extra constitutional actions that were targeted against people on the basis of their religion. But while they're doing this, they like to put on a facade that that's not what they're doing, that they're not, you know, targeting Muslims because they're Muslims and they want to create peace and engagement with Islam and all of this. So, but Trump sort of calls the bullshit flag on that. So in terms of policy of what he would do, you know, with or to Muslims, I don't think it would be much different from what a lot of neocons have been doing. But the difference is that Trump would just be, you know, saying what he wouldn't be doing, this whole facade of like, yeah, no, I like peace and I love Muslims and Islam, and the problem is just that there's a couple of them who are bad. You know, he would just sort of say that Muslims or Islam is the problem. So I think this is one of the issues with the neocons, is that they want to do these kinds of attacks against Muslims while pretending that they're not, basically. Whereas Trump is just going to do it, but say what he's doing.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Well, getting down to sort of the electoral reasons why Hillary is unlikely to do very well against Trump. You know, I've seen somebody posted a piece on this that I think I referred to a couple of weeks ago. Where was that? I don't know. Anyway, your analysis also, you know, kind of echoed some of those points and brought up some new ones. You know, why do you think that you know, Trump has such a big advantage over Hillary in a head-to-head race?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of them I talked about in the article, about if you look at how they're performing right now and what states they're performing in, the electoral map suggests that in a general election, Trump would dominate Hillary Clinton in terms of the swing states, and she would have decreased enthusiasm in the blue states and in swing states, whereas Trump would have much higher participation in red states and swing states, and so she would lose. But there's a number of other sort of markers you can look at. For instance, this race is kind of unprecedented because both Trump and Clinton have such high unfavorables. I mean, there hasn't really been a race where people have hated the two front runners as passionately as they do Trump and Clinton. But the difference is that in the case of Clinton, she has high unfavorables, but what she has high unfavorables about is her work as a politician, because that's how people know her. They know her as a politician. Whereas in the case of Trump, people's impressions about Trump are based mostly on his time during The Apprentice and things he said here and there. But everyone's still figuring out Trump, the politician. So he has a lot more opportunity to sort of move his favorables and unfavorables in a way that Hillary Clinton doesn't. So hers are very high, and they're likely to stay that way, whereas Trump's are also high. But he has more ability to move his numbers by you know, saying the right things, by confounding people's expectations of him, by presenting a more positive or thoughtful version of himself than most people would expect. And I anticipate that's exactly what he'll do. Or you could even consider a debate between Trump and Clinton, for instance. You know, Clinton would be like, here's my 5-point plan for blah, blah, blah. And Trump would be like, you're a liar, that's garbage, you know. And Clinton would respond, well, here's your factual inaccuracies here. And, you know, and it would continue. The dynamic would be, you know, the next day on the news, everyone would be like, oh, well, Clinton wiped the floor with Trump in terms of substance. And that would maybe be technically true. But if you looked at the polls after the debate, it would be, you know, Trump up, Clinton down, because she just fundamentally doesn't get, you know, what's happening and where people are. And Trump is speaking to something that's to a sentiment that is very, you know, that's very powerful right now. And this is actually one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders could beat Trump, is because in a lot of ways he speaks to that same disenfranchisement, that same alienation, because a lot of these poor and working class white people have basically been abandoned by both parties to a large extent. And Sanders can speak to those concerns in a way that Hillary Clinton can't.
Right. I think Sanders matches up better against Trump in part because he has a fairly strong, you know, case as being scandal-free, you know, basically honest, straightforward, you know, personally more difficult to hit with the kinds of attacks that Trump is so good at. Whereas Clinton, she's got all sorts of weaknesses for Trump to exploit, you know, everything from, you know, Benghazi gate to her support for the Iraq war, to her personal issues, the people who hate her, the Secret Service people who write books about how she was the most evil boss, you know, you could imagine, to her having helped go after these like 8 or 10 or however many women who all have accused Bill Clinton of rape, and she's helped destroy them. There's a lot of things that Trump could really go after with Hillary, you know, and accentuate her negatives. Whereas Bernie Sanders is pretty squeaky clean, really, and you know, yeah, he's kind of unpretentious. He'd be a tough target for Trump.
Well, I mean, the main thing they would try to do about Sanders is, like, red bait him. Like, oh, he's a socialist. But when you do polling about how Americans feel about the concept of socialism, now most Americans are cool with socialism, right? So if Bernie Sanders was running maybe 10 years ago, calling him a socialist would have been a much bigger problem than it would be today. So if Trump thinks that, if it was Trump-Sanders and the main Republican strategy against Trump would be to try to red bait him, I mean, the main Republican strategy against Sanders would be to try to red bait him. That wouldn't actually be as successful as they think it would be. Whereas Clinton, again, as you said, they've really only, you know, as much as Trump and the Republicans have said about Hillary Clinton so far, they have barely scratched the surface. I mean, they're still saving, you know, the good stuff for the general election, and there's a lot of good stuff. There's ridiculous quotes, you know, Hillary Clinton saying that she was hiding from sniper fire at one point when she was. I mean, this is ridiculous. She lies about stuff that there's no reason to lie about, and there's just such a long record of these like manipulative, shifty positions on things and gross, you know, financial dealings with unsavory actors and stuff like this. And this is where Trump actually, again, would have a lot of credibility in a sense in condemning this on the part of Hillary Clinton, because he's not accountable in the same way. He's not taking the same kind of money from these people. He's independently wealthy. He didn't enrich himself. He enriched himself doing a lot of terrible things, but not using the political process to enrich himself in the way that Hillary Clinton did. She made $130 million since the Clintons did collectively, you know, through things in the Clinton Foundation, giving speeches and consulting for Wall Street and things like this. You know, Trump, he's a businessman, and his business has done terrible, you know, things at times, laying people off, labor stuff. And you can try to use that stuff against him, but at the end of the day, it's not going to really stick in the way that Hillary Clinton says, in part because the criticisms against Clinton already play into these well-established narratives. And this is what I was talking about before, about how Clinton's unfavorables are unlikely to... she's not going to be able to really move it up. If anything, it'll go down a little bit, whereas Trump has a much greater ability to sort of to move people's perception.
Right. Yeah, I agree completely. I think the unfavorable issue is probably the single biggest issue. That, you know, Hillary has not only extreme unfavorables with the Republicans, but also to a large extent with the undecideds, you know, people who will dominate in the swing states and decide the election. Those kind of people generally tend to largely lean towards accepting the negative picture of her portrayed by her enemies. And even within the base, this huge difference between the base's attitude towards Hillary and the base's attitude toward Trump. Hillary's base, the Democrats, liberals, progressives, these kinds of people that normally would vote Democratic and sort of the more active they are on that side of the political ledger, the more, you know, the more to the left they lean. Those kind of people really are not the least bit enthusiastic about Hillary. I mean, I noticed it. Fighting Bob Fest, the leading progressive event here in Wisconsin, there was not a single Hillary sign. There were about a zillion signs for Bernie Sanders, and not one shred of visible support in this entire stadium full of left-wingers in Madison, Wisconsin, for Hillary Clinton. And that's pretty pathetic.
Yeah, and you can see it, actually. You can see it in the primaries, right? So if Hillary Clinton is in the lead, but she's won primarily in red states, she hasn't beaten Bernie Sanders decisively in a single solidly blue state, but Bernie has won in landslides in a few of them. And most recently in the Democrats Abroad primary, he won 70-30, basically, against Hillary Clinton. So the progressives, the progressive Democratic liberal base hates Hillary Clinton almost, you know, not quite to the same degree, but they're just not enthusiastic about her. And then, as you pointed out, Republicans very passionately hate the Clintons, and the independents also don't have a high opinion of her. Trump, on the flip side, you see a lot of establishment, you know, Republicans saying never Trump. They're so against Trump. But it's important to bear in mind here that the whole Trump phenomenon is an example, is a powerful statement to just how far removed from their base this Republican leadership is. And this has been brewing for a long time. So the fact that so many Republican leaders hate Trump has nothing to do with how the base will perform in a general election. The base, a lot of the base, is very passionately supportive of Trump. And the rest of them are going to get on board, if only to deny Hillary Clinton the White House, because they hate the Clintons so much.
And to be part of a winning bandwagon. You know, once the momentum is there, then a lot of these Republicans who are not crazy about Trump are obviously going to jump back on the bandwagon. And so, yeah, that difference between the two bases may not look important for the swing states and undecideds who actually determine the outcome of the election. But I think the enthusiasm kind of bleeds out from the base to the undecided voters. And there, you know, you're going to see no enthusiasm bleeding out for Hillary, and you're going to see a lot for Trump. I mean, there are lots and lots of people who are really excited about him. I mean, I see Trump signs all over the place where I live, a fair number of Sanders signs, and that's it. I don't see any signs for anybody else. I think that you're absolutely right. Well, you know, getting back to the issue of Bernie Sanders and his possibility of actually beating Trump, and you mentioned that they would red bait him, but the fact that he is a self-proclaimed socialist, which would have killed him in virtually all previous elections, may not be such a problem now. And I got to ask you, because you're younger than me. I mean, I'm actually rapidly approaching the official retirement age, which is kind of, you know, sneaking up on me. And I just wonder, how the heck did this happen? I mean, I was just like, it seems like only yesterday, and maybe it was actually more like, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, 10 years ago, that the young people were all flocking to Ron Paul. And at that, with those people, socialism was and remains a dirty word. And I had some, you know, rubbing elbows with these young folks who were really big on Ron Paul not very long ago. And suddenly, we see that the same generation, the younger people, are the ones who are now getting over this problem with socialism and flocking to Bernie Sanders. Now, are young people today schizoid, or are just waking up fast, or what? What's going on?
Well, no, I mean, so Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders have, in some ways, the same message. It's that the system, as it's rigged between Washington and various you know, establishments that are sort of tied into Washington, is not working for ordinary people, and it's not going to work for you, and you don't really have that much of a future in that system. Like, the current dynamic is not sustainable. That's the message of Trump and Sanders. It's just they have sort of a radically different approach on what to do about it. But I think that's sort of impulse is what's driving people towards Trump, Sanders, and Ron Paul in the previous election. And it's only been getting worse, you know, since the last election. But yeah, I mean, as far as socialism, though, goes, one of the issues is, you know, when people are seeing that their income is not not able to pay their bills, and they don't have great prospects for the future. They're not able to get a job, even if they go to college. If they go to college, they're in major debt. You know, it's hard to explain actually how a lot of these free market reforms would actually solve a lot of the problems that young people are faced with today. Whereas when you tell, so if you're in massive debt from your student loans, it's hard to say, well, what we need to do is, you know, introduce another market system here. Whereas if you tell people that free college, you know, that's a more obvious solution to their problem than whatever, you know, Ron Paul would offer as an alternative. So I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of young people are starting to, you know, move towards socialism.
That makes sense to me. And this is, in fact, precisely what I was telling a lot of my Ron Paul friends back in the day. You know, I ran for Congress in 2008 as the only libertarian candidate who supported a national and public health care system. And, you know, my argument was that if libertarians are for freedom, this is the model that for the lowest price will actually produce the most aggregate freedom. You'll have a lot more freedom if you have to worry about your house being taken from you if you get sick. If you're not constantly worrying about bills, you know, and all of these accountants for the insurance companies aren't being paid and enslaved, you know, the overall level of freedom for the country actually goes up when you treat health as a public utility rather than a market commodity. Naturally, my libertarian friends didn't agree, but, you know, I think we are reaching that point, though, where these kinds of so-called socialist arguments are going to make more and more sense. And there's a new book out by Douglas Rushkoff. It's called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. Rushkoff is one of the leading analysts of the Internet revolution, going way back to when he was friends with Tim Leary in the 1980s. A very sharp guy. I'm going to have him on the show soon. And he says that the corporate economy has these built-in flaws, and they've kind of reached the tipping point now. And we're going to have to come up with a new structure. He's basically suggesting economics sort of, you know, 1.2 or, you know, getting a post-corporate thing. He's saying that, you know, a real problem here is we've got this software, this corporate economic software that's been operating ever since corporations were created, not as parts of the free market, but as impediments of the free market. Corporations were all, the beginning of a corporation is a chartered corporation. It's chartered by the king. It's given a monopoly. That's what a corporation is. And then today, corporations are essentially legal means for avoiding individual responsibility. That's all it is. I mean, a corporation is saying that, you know, we're going to work together to get something done, but each of us who is funding this thing that we're getting done and thereby, you know, responsible for it, doesn't have to be responsible for it. You know, if it does something terrible, you can't get any kind of recompense from me, even though I paid for it, because it's not me that did this, it's my corporation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all they are. That's what a corporation is. So anyway, Rushkoff is pointing out that this model where these corporations have been very good at sucking in lots of investment capital, because of course everybody wants to rush to invest if they don't have to be personally responsible for anything, and they have a chance at big profits. So these corporations have been great at sucking all of the value out of anything, you know, anything they touch. But they've reached the point now where the diminishing returns are hopeless. You know, they've always been diminishing for more than 50 years. He points out that the ratio of corporate income to net worth has been going down steadily for more than half a century. They can't figure out how to squeeze more value, to loot and bleed more areas. So they go abroad, you know, they jump into the high-tech realm where it looks like a new frontier to steal more value. But they've reached the end. They can't do it anymore. The whole thing is going to collapse.
Even see a lot of CEOs now that are saying basically that same thing, that the current levels of inequality are basically not sustainable anymore. You can't have so many people struggling and barely getting by and still expect, especially a consumer-driven economy, to continue to function, because what are the consumers supposed to do? With what money are they supposed to, you know, purchase things? And especially when they're when they've reached the capacity of leveraging, you know, debt and stuff, going when access to credit is not as available because of the global financial crisis that was related to credit, from people spending, you know, more than they were able to for decades, really. The current model is not sustainable. And a lot of CEOs are saying this, and this is also the message of both Trump and Sanders. So Trump, again, this is one reason why he appeals to a lot of people who haven't been voting Republican lately, or also blue-collar people who are sort of fed up with the Republican establishment, is because he criticizes a lot of these corporate practices of moving jobs overseas and this and that. He wants to lower taxes for a lot of corporations as well, so he kind of so he's not as clearly sort of one side or the other as Bernie Sanders. But even that would appeal to a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Good point. So yeah, I think young people being, you know, really staring down the gun of this situation that we're in, maybe are quicker to see that, you know, something has to change, which would explain this huge outpouring of support for Sanders among younger people just a decade after we saw the same thing for Ron Paul. And I guess one area where both of those candidates would kind of come together would be on skepticism towards the imperial adventures, especially these imperial adventures on steroids of post 9/11. You think if Sanders did actually win, what do you think his presidency would be like internationally? Because how could he pay for these things he's promising without really scaling back the empire?
Well, he wants to. I mean, he just gave one of his first like real substantive speeches on foreign policy and national security last night. But yeah, I mean, he's expressed, you know, a lot of skepticism about U.S. involvement overseas. And not with the same kind of force as Trump, but there's a very clear difference between, I mean, but basically the package that Trump and Sanders are offering is that, like, we need to take care of Americans first, and that's going to require us to not be involved with a lot of this other stuff overseas. You know, there are certain events overseas which might require the U.S. to do something for the sake of the American people's, you know, pressing interests. But if it's not that kind of a situation, then the U.S. probably shouldn't be involved in it. And that's kind of the package that Sanders and Trump are both offering, you know, substantive variations in how they would implement that. But you're absolutely right that it's not possible to continue these kind of imperial adventures abroad at the kind of levels that we're doing it, while also taking care of, you know, Americans. I mean, even now, when we're not really providing anything near the kinds of services and benefits for Americans that virtually all other industrialized nations do, even now, the current rate of expenditures overseas, et cetera, is not sustainable. I mean, we're going into debt. We're taking out loans, you know, constantly to pay for these imperial adventures abroad. So there's certainly no way to continue that kind of thing while also, you know, providing healthcare and benefits and bolstering social safety nets, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, you have to sort of pick one or the other.
Right. And Sanders and to some extent Trump seem to be maybe a little bit out ahead of this inevitable rollback of U.S. empire, which is opposed only by the extreme neocons, who of course want their glorious thousand-year Reich, or, you know, new American century, as they put it. But even the realists like Brzezinski, and he's no pacifist, that's for sure. He's a big fan of U.S. empire and has no use for Russia or any continental land power in Asia. But even Brzezinski, in his book The Grand Chessboard, admits that what he's really playing for is not eternal U.S. global domination, because that's probably just not possible. You know, he admits that the center of the world chessboard is Eurasia. That's where most of the people, the GDP, the resources, everything's over there in Eurasia and you know, northern half of Africa. That's the center of the chessboard. And to try to rule that from North America may be possible for a little while longer, and he's all in favor of that, apparently, but not forever. So he admits that what he's really up to is trying to find a way to sort of leverage Western values globally, to try to make sure that the world that comes after U.S. and Western imperial domination, which he sees probably ending in the 2030s, will be as influenced by Western values as possible. So that's what Brzezinski's playing for, very different from the neocons with their new American century. So everybody except the neocons admits that the U.S. empire is going to have to draw down. And Sanders and Trump are just saying, hey, let's do it sooner rather than later before the whole thing really, you know, before we have a real, really serious economic catastrophe and things go haywire.
And that's what the people want. I mean, this is what drives me crazy about the Democrats, about the Democratic establishment is I can't, for the life of me, understand what they're thinking. And the cycle where people on both sides of the aisle and certainly in the middle have very passionately said that they're sick of the establishment and the status quo, when people are very clearly sick of these wars and foreign interventions overseas, why on earth they would nominate Hillary Clinton as their nominee, it like boggles my imagination. She's in many respects the exact, she represents the very thing that most Americans are railing against, you know, on almost every level, in terms of her you know, flip-flopping back and forth, her ties to Wall Street, her, you know, interventionist, hawkish policies overseas. I mean, there's no appetite for any of that with the American people right now. And that's why, in some senses, you know, Trump is almost like the perfect opposite to Clinton. Although I think Rand Paul could have also been very competitive against Hillary Clinton for this very reason, because especially if it turned into a foreign policy oriented debate, you know, Rand Paul would clearly have the edge. That's where the people are right now. They're not clamoring to intervene in Syria and dive into Ukraine, and, you know, God knows whatever else you know Hillary Clinton will come up with over her term in office if she were elected. But
yeah, it seems like Trump sort of sucked the wind out of Rand Paul's sails. The disaffected element of the Republican base, the people who were, you know, not just complete, you know, neocon dupes, were more sort of Paul supporters, and then along comes Trump, and all that energy ends up propelling him.
Well, and the reason for that, though, again, is it ties to, I think, why Bernie Sanders is successful, is because Rand Paul is against a lot of the foreign policy interventions, but then on the domestic side, his economic policy is a lot more of the is much closer to his father, whereas Trump defies a lot of the Republican orthodoxy with regards to market oriented, et cetera. You know, he's defended different social safety nets and social programs like Medicaid and Social Security. And then even on a lot of social issues, and this is actually one of the things that's going to make him damaging against Hillary Clinton in a general election, I should add, is because the Democrats often rely on these social issues like abortion and gay marriage to help turn out their base more. But Trump has, for instance, with regards to Elton John, he was like, hey, you know, Elton's a friend of mine and I'm for traditional marriage, but I think if you love someone, you should be able to marry them. In terms of abortion, he's given money to Planned Parenthood and has defended them, even very controversially, even during this round of presidential Republican primaries. So Trump is going to confound a lot of the tools that the Democrats have traditionally used to beat Republicans, relying on these social issues in particular, or on economic populism. Trump has embraced both of those things. He's embraced economic populism on a lot of the social issues. He's sort of radically different from the Republican orthodoxy. And then on foreign policy, he's where the people are at in terms of we should be involved less overseas. And if we are going to be involved overseas, there should be a clear benefit for the United States rather than, you know, a cost.
If that's his position, then of course he should be radically questioning the Israeli domination of the American political system. And of course, maybe that's why the neocons are concerned about him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the, you don't see this as often, you know, really anywhere else in the world, where the AIPAC speeches blow my mind, that you have all of these U.S. politicians, you know, going up there and basically saying that Israel's concerns and priorities are, either equivalent to those of the U.S., or even if they're not, that they'll put Israel's priorities ahead of our own. You know, we're willing to incur costs in terms of our own national security and national interests in order to advocate for Israel's. And you really don't see that kind of position being taken by any other nation, or even by the U.S. with regards to any other nation. And it is kind of crazy when you think about it, because the whole purpose of the U.S. government is to promote the will and interests and principle of the U.S. people. So, I mean, the government is really not doing its job, in a sense, if it's advocating for people in another country at the expense of its own citizens.
It's a taboo to even talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. But Trump is, he's known for breaking those taboos. And in his AIPAC speech, you know, he does double down, though, on a lot of Republican tropes about anti-Semitism, for instance, on U.S. campuses, and how the Palestinians are really probably the bigger problem in this, because they have a culture of violence and extremism. So he does play to a lot of that sort of Republican orthodoxy. But at the same time, he's saying that, and has continued to articulate throughout, that what he would like to do is to create a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that will require the U.S. to take a more neutral position, probably. And he's also said that at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel relationship has to be a mutually beneficial relationship. If it's just the U.S. sacrificing for Israel, and Israel, you know, doing whatever it wants, or even, antagonizing the United States, then that's not a dynamic that's going to work, you know, for Trump.
That's interesting. Well, and Bernie Sanders also is, his position on Israel is, it sounds good from within sort of the normal liberal American paradigm. But if you read it carefully, as Cynthia McKinney just told us, she just emailed me her position paper on Sanders' speech, or his position on Mideast policy, that this is, it's really quite unbalanced, because Sanders is just assuming that this is a conflict between two equal parties, you know, equal in power and equal in the justice of their cause. And he's assuming that kind of the first thing that has to be done is to stop these terrible, terrible attacks by, you know, Hamas and so on. And this is, of course, completely ridiculous. I saw Bernie Sanders actually heckled at Fighting Bob Fest a couple of years ago by a friend of mine, David Williams, who just gave him an earful for supporting the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. And then the next speaker, Chris Hedges, supported the heckler and basically agreed that that Bernie Sanders deserved to be heckled for his ridiculous position on Palestine. What do you think about Sanders in his position?
Yeah, so absolutely. So he is, his position on Israel is, seems radical, but that's only because the current sort of consensus position between Democrats and Republicans is so overwhelmingly unbalanced. But yeah, he does sort of, in many respects, draw a moral equivalency between Israel and Palestine that, you know, probably doesn't hold up to scrutiny so well. And he does, toe the line as far as Israel has a right to defend itself from attacks, and Israelis, you know, should expect some measure of security. And that can be a turnoff for a lot of liberals. But at the same time, he's very critical of the settlements, and he's critical of needlessly antagonizing Palestinians, or treating Palestinians like second-class citizens within Israel. So his position is better than basically than anyone else that we've really had at this level of consideration for the presidency in some time. I mean, really, since, I don't know, maybe Eisenhower or something. We haven't had a serious presidential contender, like top-tier finalist kind of contender, for one of the parties who's been as critical as Bernie is. It's not a perfect position, but it's better than most of the other alternatives.
Yeah, he might pose a real impediment to the hardline like Kudniks and neocons if they're indeed planning to up the ante. And, you know, a lot of us think that their plan is to essentially finish the ethnic cleansing of Palestine under the cover of the fog of war. That's why they were looking to start a huge Mideast war with a U.S. attack on Iran. And they've already destabilized their region a lot. They think they can thrive better with war. And you know, you've got a lot of the Israeli public now favoring the expulsion of non-Jewish citizens of Israel, and not to mention the Palestinians in the creation of Greater Israel, totally populated by nothing but Jews. It sounds ridiculous, but it could happen under the fog of war, just like back in 1948. I think Bernie as president would probably, that would be, you know, that just wouldn't work with him. So maybe that's one reason that wing of the World Zionist movement is not very enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders, even though he's Jewish.
Yeah, he's the first Jewish person to ever reach, again, to ever come this close to the presidency, to be one of the finalist nominees for one of the major parties and winning, you know, several primaries. This has never happened before for a Jewish person, but you're right that there's this major enthusiasm gap between a lot of the, especially the more hawkish elements of the Jewish demographic in America tend to gravitate more towards Hillary Clinton because she takes a hardline position on Iran. She takes, she's very tight sort of with Netanyahu, with the whole sort of Likud approach to a lot of these issues, as was underscored very powerfully in her speech at AIPAC yesterday. And what's ironic, or maybe not, is that Sanders actually has a lot of support from the Arab American and Muslim communities in America.
Yeah, they won in Michigan.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. And my friend MD Alam, whom I work with at the American Muslim Political Action Committee, takes a certain amount of credit for, he's been really working hard for Bernie Sanders in both Missouri and in Michigan. And yeah, he points out that Bernie is the current favorite candidate in the American Muslim community, which means maybe American Muslims have learned something since Samuel Arian organized them to help get Bush elected in 2000, which turned out to be a bad move. It didn't look like one at the time, but in retrospect, that was obviously a mistake.
Yeah, at the time, Bush seemed like a very sensible candidate for Muslims in a lot of ways. A lot of Muslims are kind of socially conservative, but not like, in an authoritarian kind of way. And Bush was advocating this compassionate conservatism, which would marry a lot of conservative ideals with also, you know, trying to help people who were less fortunate and all of this, like placing a greater priority on that kind of altruistic aspect of conservatism, and that appealed to a lot of Muslims. And then his stance that we should, his foreign policy position as well, really appealed to a lot of Muslims, that the U.S. shouldn't be so deeply engaged in a lot of places around the world, and they shouldn't be invading countries and trying to state build. And a lot of Muslims appreciated that as well. Unfortunately, candidate George Bush is not who they got as President George Bush, because of 9/11 and the way a lot of his advisors in particular moved his policy. What's interesting is that late term George Bush, much like late term Barack Obama, was much different, right? So a lot of these people like Cheney and the neocons were alienated towards the end of the Bush presidency. He kind of...
Right. They couldn't get their attack on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he realized that... that they had not served him well, and that they had sort of pushed his policy into a place that he probably never wanted or expected to go.
Yeah, that's interesting how that there is that pattern that repeats itself in late Bush presidency and then late Obama as well. When Obama refuses to go along with the false flag in al-Ruta, Syria, and carpet bomb Syria, and so hopefully the next president will wake up to the neocon machinations a little bit earlier. Anyway, we hit the end of the hour, but thank you. It's been a great conversation. Musa Harvi, I appreciate your excellent work. Keep it up. Hope to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care.